This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's important to start by recognizing that while the threat from militant Islamist groups in Africa is expanding, it isn't taking hold across the whole continent. It's really operating in three main theaters in the Sahel, Lake Chad Basin, and the Somalia area, and then to a lesser degree in Egypt and in Mozambique.
That's Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, talking on how terror groups are intensifying their grip in parts of Africa. Details coming up also. After months of COVID-19 lockdowns, Zimbabwe is making moves to reopen its economy. And the Red Cross and Red Crescent societies are appealing for millions of dollars to help the people of Sudan affected by serious flooding. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Despite counter-terrorism campaigns, the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, and other groups are intensifying their grip on communities across large parts of Africa. By manipulating domestic grievances, they have garnered support for violent operations that are on the rise in the Sahel and Lake Chad region and elsewhere. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, about terrorism on a continent that is home to over 1 billion people.
It's important to start by recognizing that while the threat from militant Islamist groups in Africa is expanding, it isn't taking hold across the whole continent. It's really operating in three main theaters in the Sahel, Lake Chad Basin, and the Somalia area, and then to a lesser degree in Egypt and in Mozambique. I think second, it's important, it's not one unified threat. Rather, there are some 24 different militant Islamist groups. These are often locally based, focusing on primary local issues. Now, they do claim some allegiance to the global jihadi networks, but for the most part, there's very little evidence that they get support financially, materially, in terms of arms, fighters, or even direction from the global jihadi network. So these are mostly locally based groups. You ask, why are they gaining more traction? And I think this is a real challenge right now. We have seen a significant increase in the level of activity of these groups. Last year alone, we've seen a 31% growth. So in the past year, there were 4,100 violent episodes from these militant Islamist groups. And they're able to gain traction for a couple of reasons. You know, mainly that they're operating in places where there are weak African governments. So the evidence of these groups is as much a symptom of the weakness and fragility of these governments as a sign of the strength of the militant group. Next is groups are working in largely operational and marginalized peripheral areas of their respective countries. And so they are reaching out to marginalized communities, almost always Muslim communities, and playing up on local grievances and helping to spin a narrative that the government is responsible for these communities' marginalization, and you know, the government is corrupt, the government is uncaring, and as a result, these groups are appealing these communities for recruits and support to advance their militant cause. And I think the governments haven't helped their cause by sometimes responding indiscriminately to these communities and being responsible for human rights abuses, and alienating some of these communities and therefore furthering the cause of the militant groups. These militant groups have gained more traction because they've been able to gain more resources. They've expanded the way they've been able to get money. They use extortion, they use kidnapping for ransom, they've been part of human trafficking and smuggling networks, they've been part of other protection rackets. So there's a whole host of revenue sources that they've been able to control, which has helped them be resilient and increase their capability.
So what do we know about these organizations' strategies and ambitions on a continent that is home to over 1 billion people?
We're talking about 24 different groups in 5 different parts of the continent. And so their goals and ambitions are different and they're changing. I think by and large, there's often a starting point where they are calling for some sort of Islamic state as a counterpoint to the existing governments in these countries. You know, these calls are often based on some ideological messaging that is calling for a more pure form of Islam. It's often generated from the Arab world and an interpretation of Islam that is far more conservative and intolerant than historically has been the case in Africa. But in terms of what they have done with that, there really isn't a lot of evidence of these groups showing a willingness or interest in governing. Rather, they are more focused on disrupting and recruiting, and increasingly, they're acting often as criminal networks. So they're controlling access to revenues. They become better at extorting whatever economic activity is in the areas that they can control. And this has allowed them to be resilient and disruptive.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. The Zimbabwe government is making moves to reopen the economy, with so many sectors in dire need of revival after months of COVID-19 lockdowns. Kudzaiza Nawashi reports.
Information Minister Monica Mutswangwa recently outlined plans to ease lockdown restrictions and open an economy that had been in a tailspin even before the pandemic hit the country.
Government is finalizing on modalities for the reopening of airports to support the resumption of the tourism sector. The plan is to start with the resumption of domestic flights and then move to international flights. Cabinet approved the resumption of the rest of tourism operations, including boat operations. Regarding primary and secondary education, the ministry is continuing with its preparations for the reopening of schools for the end of year 2020 final examination classes.
Domestic flights have been allowed to operate beginning Thursday, and international flights will begin October 1st. Clive Chimwanda is with the Hospitality Association of Zimbabwe. He hailed the move to resume air travel.
The opening up of the skies is a welcome development in so far as our industry is concerned. The COVID-induced restrictions of the past few months have been crippling to the sector. It will result in confidence coming back.
He says, while air travel is an enabler, it doesn't necessarily mean tourism destinations will be pegged during the holiday season, because some travelers plan seasonal vacations months in advance. President of the Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, Obed Masaraure, however, is skeptical whether proper measures have been put in place for schools to open.
Government is seized with the publicity stunts as they try to do a lot of propaganda around their preparedness for schools opening. What they must be focusing on is to ensure that these basics are provided for in our schools. We've been communicating with the National Association of Secondary Schools Heads. They are confirming that there is nothing that is being deployed in our schools.
Government has promised to provide personal protection equipment and transport to both learners and teachers. Passengers Association of Zimbabwe President Tafadzwa Goliath says the public transport will be further strained.
Public service vehicles are already inadequate in failing to cope with the current demand. They will be overwhelmed by students and teachers' demand in addition to existing commuters.
Public sentiment is mixed about the economy reopening. Some are happy the dry spell in their income may be ending, while others worry about their safety once they get back to work. For VOA, this is Kudzaiza Nawashi from Harare.
The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies is appealing for millions of dollars to support the Sudanese Red Crescent Society in delivering assistance to people affected by flooding. Because of heavy rainfall, since July, 16 of Sudan's 18 states are flooded, with Sinnar, Khartoum, and Al-Ghazira affected the most. The president of Sudan's Red Crescent Society, Ilfadi Iltahir, says the magnitude of the flooding disaster is unprecedented, affecting more than 500,000 people. The SRCS will use the funds from the emergency appeal to provide emergency shelter materials, household items, drinking water, and primary health care to prevent disease outbreaks. Somali health authorities say the number of maternal checkups and childhood vaccinations have plunged during the pandemic as many people fear catching COVID-19 at clinics and hospitals. Healthcare workers worry the lack of medical care for pregnant women and children could result in a wave of common diseases that take more victims than COVID-19. Mohammed Sheikh Noor reports from Mogadishu.
Amina Mustafa and her family were displaced by drought 3 years ago and have since been living in a Mogadishu relief camp. Her three-week-old baby needed vaccinations, but she was too afraid of catching COVID-19 to go to a clinic. She says that it is a common fear among mothers in the camp. Mustafa says that she couldn't go to a healthcare facility because of this COVID-19 is spreading across the world. I feared for my health and that of my child, she says. Mustafa says because they are scared of contracting the virus at the health facility. She says they missed important prenatal and postnatal vaccinations, all because of COVID-19. Somali healthcare workers are alarmed by the sharp decline in child immunizations and visits to clinics during the pandemic. Volunteers like Saadia Ahmed with local health group Sordo are going door to door, urging families to vaccinate their children. But it is no easy task, she says. Every mother, whether pregnant or lactating, are not ready to come to the health facility for vaccination, says Ahmed. Most fear contracting COVID-19. If left unaddressed, Somalia could see a jump in respiratory infections, measles and malnutrition, says the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC. The ICRC says visitors to Somali Red Crescent clinics by children under 5 and pregnant women dropped by more than half in the first 7 months of this year compared to 2019. ICRC health officer Ahmed Noor says the risk of them catching common diseases is high, especially among the vulnerable. He says COVID-19 has badly affected the entire country and forced mothers and children not to come to health centers for vaccinations in fear of the virus. Noor says the fall in vaccinations will result in more and more children contracting contagious disease. Somalia's health ministry admits there is a problem. The ministry's national incident COVID-19 director Abdirazaq Yusuf says they are taking measures. He says that they indeed realized vaccination numbers have dramatically dropped due to the emergence of COVID-19. Nonetheless, Somalia's health ministry is exploring new ways to urge people to embrace vaccinations as a way of preventing contagious diseases and reducing child mortality rates. Flooding around Mogadishu in recent months also risks waterborne disease, warns the ICRC. The floods are further straining Somalia's pandemic-stretched health system and only adding to the worries of mothers like Mustafa. Mohammed Sheikh Noor for VOA News, Mogadishu.
A disabled 9-year-old boy in Malawi is showing his community that being born with physical challenges doesn't make living a full and fun life impossible. Talandira Kogoya was born with only one limb and no hands, but taught himself how to play football and ride a bicycle, among other activities. A documentary about him has been nominated for Australia's Focus on Ability Short Film Festival next month. Lamek Masina reports from Palombe District in southern Malawi.
Raising 9-year-old Dalandila, who was born with no hands and only one complete limb, was not easy for the Kogoya family. Agnes Kogoya is Dalandila's mother. She says some women were laughing at me when they saw us riding on a bicycle to school. They would say that they wouldn't bother to take such a child to school every day. I would just ignore them and say to myself, this is a God-given child. But the Southern Malawi community's judgment of Dalandila changed when he proved that being disabled does not mean being helpless. Dalandila is now able to ride, play football, and ride a bicycle. His self-taught skills were featured in a local documentary called Chosen, which was nominated for Australia's October Focus on Ability Short Film Festival. Malawi authorities say Dalandila's story sets a great example for other disabled people and how they should be supported. Biton Impilisi is a social welfare assistant in Palombe District.
We are very proud of Dalandila being engaged in a competition. This will assist other parents to come out and expose their children to various social activities, that they can be assisted a lot and they can achieve what they are expecting in the future.
Dalandila's mother is confident that the documentary about her son will do well at the festival. She says the dedication and wisdom that he has are what makes me believe that my son's documentary will win the award. As for this young student, his dreams do not stop in Australia. Dalandila says he plans to fly airplanes one day. He says, I want to be a pilot because they fly people to various destinations across the world. I also want to see those places. In the meantime, Dalandila is happy piloting his bicycle around the neighborhood. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Palombe, Malawi.
Ethiopians are celebrating their new year, following a calendar 7 years behind the Gregorian one used by much of the world. Today, Ethiopians marked the beginning of 2013. AP reports that church services marking the new year were more subdued than usual. However, in the busy open-air markets of the capital Addis Ababa, many people were going about their lives as before. Some were walking without face masks, acting as if there is no coronavirus. Coronavirus cases have begun to rise rapidly in Africa's second most populous country. Ethiopia has more than 62,000 confirmed cases as of today, including 1,000 deaths. The government let a state of emergency expire over the weekend, opening the way for more public gatherings. Already deeply damaged by the COVID-19 pandemic, South Africa is once again in an energy generation crisis costing its economy. The country's electricity utility, Eskom, blames the latest blackouts on equipment breakdowns at several power stations. But some energy analysts say the corporation isn't being entirely truthful. Darren Taylor reports.
Eskom cuts electricity to parts of South Africa when its stations can't keep up with energy demand, a process called load shedding. Over the past 2 weeks, the state-owned company declared load shedding level 4. This meant it had to turn off the power for hours on end to save 4,000 megawatts. But former Eskom executive and energy expert Ted Blom says the situation's much worse than the corporation's managers say.
They only declared load shedding level 4. However, when I got the statistics after the peak, I saw that on Wednesday evening they dumped 5,300 and something megawatts of power. So that's level 6. It's up to 6,000 megawatts.
Eskom says it can't fully satisfy the need for electricity because previous managers didn't maintain essential equipment. mismanagement and corruption reigned at the company during the administration of South Africa's previous president, Jacob Zuma. But Blom puts the latest energy crisis down to simple incompetence, because Eskom didn't ensure enough diesel for emergency generators.
They sort of run the generators even during the day, because they are critically short of even baseload power. That's the minimum amount of power that the economy needs to run on a daily basis, and that is around about 30,000 megawatts. And in the last two or three days, Eskom's only been able to generate 28,000 megawatts on their own.
Eskom spokesperson Sikonati Manchancha denies that the utility ran out of diesel. In fact, he says, the electricity cuts can be partly explained by the company's success in keeping its generators going.
Each time you run a generator, you then have to stop the generator and fill the diesel again. We said we will again load shed this weekend because we need to replenish these supplies. You cannot pour diesel at a generator that is running at that time.
Manchancha, however, adds that the managers of two power stations have been suspended for apathetic behavior following the latest breakdowns.
This is indeed the start of a culture where people have to be held accountable for their performance or lack thereof. It cannot be business as usual that we will come every afternoon and make explanations and excuses as to why we have to plunge the country into load shedding.
Blom says it's too early to celebrate this as a big step towards a better state energy corporation.
Time will tell, but I think that the responsibility starts at the top. And we need to know why Eskom has been misleading the public. There needs to be some sort of cultural change. But cultural change is definitely not something that happens overnight.
The analyst isn't surprised by the apparent apathy at Eskom, because he says almost half its workforce of 40,000 employees is redundant.
Eskom has digitized over the last 25, 30 years, and the capacity output is no more than when Eskom had 32,000 staff in 2008. I mean, I don't understand the rationale for all the extra people. Now, if you've got 18,000 extra people floating around the organization with no work to do, well, obviously it's a culture that of a holiday farm.
The government acknowledges that Eskom has been grossly overstaffed for more than a decade. Eskom itself has said it's planning staffing cuts, although according to news reports, the company's powerful unions have resisted those plans. And, says Blom, the government won't give the green light to retrenchments for fear of a strike that would sink the company and the economy into even greater chaos. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokriya Barov, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hey, Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.